podcast.
Actually, it's both.
Never mind. So while Sherry's reporting through RNGC, I'm going to go sit next to Ed and throw out little expletives with that shift like sort of style.
Yeah.
If you wouldn't mind, this is not the first time you've been to Indianapolis, right, Sherry?
No, I was here in 2015 for the Final Four.
All right, okay. You like our sports here.
I enjoyed it. Ooh, that's loud. It was a great weekend.
But thank you so much for coming in. You guys give a small round of applause for here. Thanks for coming. There'll probably be a few other people that trickle in.
That's totally fine. We'll shoot them later. Am I good?
Oh, Susan, are you good?
There we go. So that's me. Is this a good volume? I will try and not shout at you through the microphone here. They need this in order for this to be recorded. So I'm double fisting in a very unusual way at the moment with the microphone and the advancer here, as opposed to two lines, which is what I'm used to. So yes, my name is Sherry Moreno. I am a North Carolina-based master of wine, originally from New York. I have the pleasure of being here today to talk to you about the Rutherford Wine Company, the Rutherford Ranch Wines, and the Scott Family Estate Wines. So without further ado, we are going to jump right in. We're going to start out with the wines that are at the top of your mat, the Rutherford Ranch wines. So we've got a Chardonnay Reserve and a Cabernet Reserve. We're going to spend just a little bit of time going through with some information about these different appellations. One of the things that we're going to kind of use this tasting for is to think about these different AVAs within California, the Carneros Appellation, Rutherford / Napa Valley, and then also Russian River Valley in Sonoma, and then Arroyo Seco, which is down in Monterey. And so we're going to use these wines as kind of a lens to look at grape varieties and also different appellations and the influence that that those AVAs can have on the grape varieties and the styles of wine. So this is our map of Napa Valley, probably one you all are pretty familiar with, right? And so we are going to be focusing today on the Napa side of Carneros, right down here. And then we're going to be tasting the grapes from, it's actually a combination of mostly Rutherford fruit and then a little bit of oak knoll fruit down here. And the Rutherford property is over on this side, over near the Silverado Trail. So Napa Valley is a pretty interesting AVA. It's about 30 miles long, runs parallel to the California coast, and at its widest point is only about 5 miles wide. So it is long and actually fairly narrow in scope. It's bordered by two mountain ranges. You've got the Mayacamas and the Baca ranges, providing the western and the eastern border. And so then you end up with a variety of different microclimates within this, because you have valley floor, you've got hillside vineyards, you've got some that are a little bit steeper, and then of course you've got a lot of geologic diversity to the area as well. So the climate is overall one that you would describe as a dry Mediterranean climate with warm and dry summers, cool rainy winters, and some influence that's going to really create some of those microclimates that's going to come from fog and the cool maritime air that comes up from San Pablo Bay and also from proximity to the Pacific Ocean. And so one of the things that's kind of interesting about this idea of this warm, dry summer and sort of the dry fall temperatures that you get is when you think about harvest and you think about some of the grape varieties that you find in the Napa Valley, specifically Cabernet Sauvignon, you think about other locations around the world where Cab is grown, such as Bordeaux, for instance, that can have issues with rain and harvest. To have this longer harvest time in the fall, a drier harvest time, really does benefit Cabernet. It likes that longer hang time on the vine, and that's what's going to help ripen those tannins and create that really beautiful structure and ripe fruit within the wine. So this is, I don't have a huge background in geology, although one of my college courses that actually has proved to be maybe more helpful in my life was geology of national parks. Some might call it rocks for jocks, but it actually has proved a helpful class as a wine person. Geology plays a really important role in wine. In fact, to the point that we really still don't even fully understand that influence of soil and the nutrients from the vine, that whole concept of minerality in wine, right? And we could spend an entire day, week, years talking about minerality and what does that mean and how do you taste for minerality? How do you describe minerality? Where does it truly come from? Is it, some people will argue that it has to do with sulfur or that it has to do with the soils or that, you know, you can actually taste. I mean, how many of you actually go around tasting rocks? Not since you were a kid, right? Yeah, I knew you were going to raise your hand, Arthur. But, you know, that whole concept of terroir and minerality of wine is a really interesting one. And I think at the very least, we can all agree that the role of soil becomes important in terms of the ability to grow grapes, finding the right place to grow grapes, and especially finding well-draining soils that produce ripe grapes. That at the very least, those are some things that we want to look for. And so when you find these sort of gravelly, loam, sandy soils, that idea of volcanic and marine sediments, if you think about some of the great wine-producing regions in the world, a lot of times they have some of these different soil types in common. They have that well-draining aspect to them. They're usually low in fertility. And so all of this kind of comes together in a nice little package within the Napa Valley. I often like to look at these maps. They're some of my favorite wine maps are these geology maps, because if you almost think about as a kid taking that fistful of crayons and just scribbling all over the page, and if you think about a country, there's a great map of France that has sort of that scribbly, you know, all the different colors to show the geology, but that's actually just Napa Valley there. So you really get a sense of the incredible soil diversity that you find just within the Napa Valley AVA. So it actually, when you start to think about that whole concept of old world versus new world and that idea of soil matching, you know, that, oh, in Burgundy, they only grow Chardonnay and Pinot because they have these limestone soils and they've got some clay, blah, blah, blah. And in Bordeaux, you know, we've got these gravelly soils and you know, we've got just different soils in the old world that match up with all these grape varieties. And then you think about the new world, and a lot of us have said, oh, well, they just grow anything and everything. Well, actually, there could be a method to that madness, right? That if you've got such diversity of soil types and you've got a climate that's great for growing grapes, then it kind of actually makes sense to have diversity of grape varieties within a region as well. So I like to sort of challenge both the idea of new world, old world, and also this idea of terroir being unique to the old world. I think terroir can be found anywhere in the world because terroir is at its ultimate, a sense of place. And so as you get bigger, if you think about concentric circles, if you're blending from a wide variety of regions, then yes, you're going to have more of sort of a dilute sense of a particular place. But if you're pulling grapes from a particular vineyard in a specific site, in a specific location, then absolutely you can have that sense of a place, a sense of the characteristics of a place. And that's one of the things that we're going to be coming back to today is this whole idea of a sense of place. So kind of getting back to the Napa Valley, we have all of these geologic events that took place billions and millions of years ago. Tectonic plate movement, volcanic activity. I'm still, every time I go out to California, holding my breath. Please let this not be the big one that's going to happen while I'm out in the state. But years and years ago, obviously, we had a lot of upheaval, a lot of lift. We had the movement of water through the area, which, of course, leaves behind dried riverbeds and things like that. Those all tend to be really sort of fine soil types that can be very appropriate for growing grapes. So we have this valley floor, the low-sloping alluvial fans. Alluvial fans are usually very, again, well-draining, fine soils, very narrow valleys, steep mountain slopes and ridges. If you've ever driven through parts of Sonoma and Napa and never get car sick, I can read in the back of a car on most windy, twisty roads. But the one time in my life where I have gotten slightly car sick is driving from Sonoma to Napa through some of those hills. Those roads can be particularly windy and twisty. The Napa Valley is also kind of interesting because it became California's first AVA, first viticultural area in 1981. But it was actually not the first AVA in the United States, believe it or not, even though we probably consider it our most important AVA within the U.S. Anybody know where the first one was?
Yes.
In Missouri? Yeah. Yeah, Missouri. Long history of grape growing in this country, actually. We forget about the fact that there were vineyards throughout the United States at one point in time. Prior to Prohibition, actually, North Carolina produced a tremendous amount of grapes. We still do a lot of muscadine grapes, so a lot of non-vinifera. But Missouri has a thriving wine industry. Pretty much every state in the U.S. has a bonded winery. They're not necessarily growing grapes in Alaska, but they are bringing in juice and making wine. I haven't had Alaskan wine. Has anybody? I had wine from Hawaii, and my parents recently brought me. They were very excited. They're like, it's a bottle of Florida wine. Gee, thanks. they keep asking. They're like, have you opened it yet? I'm like, gosh, no. I'll get to that. Thank you. But hey, every state. So Rutherford, as I mentioned, is one of the appellations we're going to be focusing in on here, and that's located pretty much in the middle of the valley. It is widely considered to be prime real estate for imageworthy Napa cabs. It is that mix of volcanic and marine sedimentary soils, that alluvial loam and sand. And in fact, that western benchland is where you find one of these famous sort of alluvial fans. And part of the reason why they tend to talk about this concept of tasting soil in Rutherford wines, they talk about Rutherford dust. Not 100% sure that dust is necessarily a great word to associate with wine. I've often sort of wondered about that. Apparently it was sort of coined by Andrei Telichev to describe kind of that sensation on the palate, the combination of the tannins. And we can have sort of dusty tannins, but I think it's hard for a consumer to wrap their head around the idea of dust in a glass of wine, right? You know, think about fruit and maybe think about fir tannins, but not necessarily dust, especially if you've ever had to clean your house and think about dust. That's not what you're looking for. But I think it's the sense of place of the combination of the microclimate and the soils within Rutherford that you do have that combination of earth and fruit and firm tannins and good acidity within Rutherford calves. It again became an AVA in 1993. This is our map of Carneros. We're going to talk about both appellations first here before we taste. I often like to describe it as kind of like a butterfly shape. It helps me to remember different places on maps to associate them with something. And for me, I remind myself that this is an appellation that crosses both Napa and Sonoma. So it's sort of, in my mind, a bit of a butterfly shape. Carneros is also a little bit different because it was the first AVA to be awarded based on climatic characteristics rather than political boundaries. And so that is one reason why it crosses over Napa and Sonoma. It's the coolest and the windiest AVA in Napa and Sonoma, which is why it becomes an appropriate place to grow Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. We have this influence of the San Pablo Bay with the morning and the afternoon fog, and we also have the influence of wind coming in off the bay as well. It's a fairly dry area. There's less rain compared to, say, Russian River Valley, which we're also going to be tasting wines from today. You find some shallow topsoils over some clay. Clay, of course, can have a benefit as a soil type because it can retain some water to it. So if you are dealing with a drier area, clay can be something that comes into play as holding some moisture that can deliver moisture to the grapes in a drier season. It was recognized very early on by many of the early pioneers in the California wine industry, including Andre Telichev and Louis Martini, who were in the area planting as early as the 1930s and 40s. So the Rutherford Ranch wines that we're going to be tasting today, the winery was established in 1972, located off of the Silverado Trail. It is a winery that's committed to sourcing from a variety of different Napa Valley and then California microclimates to create wines that really have that sense of place. The winery is a CCSW and a CC. The vineyards are CCSF. Are you guys familiar? Have you talked about biodynamic and organic and sustainable viticulture and things like that?
Addressed a little bit.
Yeah. So certainly a very topical issue these days, especially with what California has been dealing with over the last couple of years in terms of drought and water management. Wine making is an incredibly water intensive sport, shall we say, and requires a tremendous amount of water, and managing your water both in the winery and the vineyard is extremely important, and being responsible and a good steward of the environment. So California has been putting a lot of focus, a lot of wine regions around the world have been putting a lot of focus on creating a better understanding of what their area needs in terms of environmental needs. And so whether it's pest management or use of chemicals or not using chemicals in the vineyard, what's good for the vineyard workers, what you're doing with water and management in the winery, all of those kind of come into play, whether you're looking at sustainability or organics and biodynamics. And sustainability is it's a word that a lot of people sort of throw around, but it's becoming a more and more valuable word these days in the industry as we talk about this continuous cycle of improvement and management within both the vineyards and the winery. Chardonnay, or as we talked about earlier during the podcast, Chardonnay, if you're going to say it with the right French accent. We were talking about, yeah, question.
Just curious, would you say like a major separate factor between something like sustainable agriculture versus certified organic? Would you put that on the shoulders of sulfur and use of sulfur? Or
not necessarily these days, because you do have a lot of people who are looking to use less and less sulfur, but not necessarily calling themselves organic or looking for organic certification. I think in many ways that the separation there comes down to sort of chemical usage, especially in the vineyard. I think with the MW, we have part of the process of the MW involves sitting a theory exam where you have to write essays and you answer a lot of questions. And we've had questions over the years that have asked about organic and biodynamic viticulture, and what we see that's kind of interesting in candidates is this tendency to say one is better than the other, or it's almost like the cultured yeast versus indigenous yeast discussion, right? That all indigenous yeast is great, all cultured yeast bad. And we have a tendency to kind of divide these issues, and I think talking to growers over the years, that issue of organic, biodynamic, and sustainability or sustainable viticulture, it becomes so much more nuanced. And when you think about, you've got growers in places that if they have organic certification and they have a really rainy year and they are forced to use some sort of chemical to protect their crop because of their livelihood, then they lose that certification. And so there's a huge risk involved when it comes to getting that actual certification. And so I know a lot of growers who operate for the most part organically, but they like to have that backup plan available to them that they're not going to lose certification that they've paid for. I think in my mind, ultimately at the end of the day, paying attention to what is happening in your vineyard and not going out and massively proactively treating, but watching and paying attention and responding to the environment becomes much more important. I mean, I'm sure you all have had really crappy organic wine, really crappy biodynamic wine, really crappy any kind of wine. And so at the end of the day, does it make a wine better? I think the winemaker and the vineyard, the grapes, all of those things in my mind become more important than is it organic? Is it biodynamic? Is it, I pay attention to those things. I think a lot of consumers don't necessarily because they there's an interesting sort of, you know, wine is, red wine especially, is healthy overall, so it doesn't matter what, you know, is it, and a lot of people are labeling it as organic or biodynamic, et cetera, et cetera. I think in my mind, what I'm looking for is somebody who's paying attention to what's happening and not necessarily going out and just spraying everything. And so I think whether it's sustainable or organic or biodynamic, I think you can produce some amazing wines in all three of those. Does that kind of answer?
Yeah, no, I was just curious to your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, the more you're paying attention to what's happening in the vineyard and the winery, I think the better chance you have of producing quality wine overall. Back to Chardonnay. So Chardonnay, I'm a big, obviously, probably guessed by now, a little bit of a wine geek, maybe a big wine geek. And the story of grapes, the history of grapes, the DNA analysis that we've done on grapes, I think is so fascinating. I'm waiting for CSI DNA grape variety thing TV show to come out. Maybe that could be the ultimate TV show for wine, is DNA analysis.
Small audience,
yeah. Well, I don't know. We could put Marge Helberger on and maybe Scarlett Johansson, and then we'd have a show. Anyway, Chardonnay, I remember vividly the, you know, the New York Times article that came out when they finally did the DNA analysis on Chardonnay. And there was this huge sort of, oh my gosh, we didn't expect this reaction, that I found really funny, because there was this assumption that Chardonnay is sort of the king, and we can debate whether it's Chardonnay or Riesling, but one of the leading white grapes of the world, should have two amazing parents, right? It had, obviously, it's a grape of high quality, therefore it came from two high-quality grapes. Well, it did come from one high-quality grape, Pinot, and we think that Chardonnay was born, actually, in Burgundy. There is a Chardonnay village, literally a Chardonnay village in Burgundy, so there is a theory that Chardonnay was born there. But what we discovered was that the other parent was a grape called Gueuze Blanc. Have you guys talked about this at all? Am I repeating myself? No? So,
if anyone remembered the slide on Chardonnay, it discusses its crossing and repair.
Right. Okay. So romantic things happen in vineyards and by the moonlight, and grapes can produce both sexually and asexually. And there was a time when you had to provide your peasant working class something to drink, right? Because you couldn't really drink the water, not very safe. So you had to give them, or you should... you probably needed to give them some wine for their work. And so you obviously didn't want to give them the good stuff. You save that for the ruling class. And so what they did was, there was this workhorse grape that they think they brought from sort of Central Europe over with them, probably Romans or those who came slightly after. They brought this Gueuze Blanc grape, and they grew that kind of above and below where they planted Pinot. And as I said, Moonlight Vineyards, we know what happens. And we have offspring of this crossing. You have a couple different grapes that came out of that marriage, actually, one of which is Chardonnay. So it was a little bit like finding the king and the finding out that the king and the town prostitute had had a child. But that's how we ended up with Chardonnay. So it is a grape that a lot of people call the winemaker's grape, because it is a grape that responds really well in the winery to different techniques, whether it's the use of oak, new oak, old oak, some old, some new, a mix, whether it's these days using cement eggs or stainless steel tanks, malolactic fermentation, lees aging, lees stirring. All of these are going to affect the aroma profile, the flavor profile, the texture of the wine in the mouth. And so we really can run the gamut from this sort of cucumber, steely, stony profile all the way down to vanilla, toast, and butter, buttered popcorn, things like that. And as it ages, and Chardonnay is absolutely capable of aging, you get some of these really interesting aromas of honey and nuts and butterscotch and almost more sort of savory herbs. Chardonnay can also run the gamut in terms of that sort of almost light body to full-bodied and really rich and unctuous, medium to crisp acidity, and it can be, these days, if you're picking early, almost on the low side of alcohol, but it can really sort of settle nicely between, these days, 13.5% to 14%, even 14.5% alcohol, depending on the climate. So we're going to start out, you can finally taste some wine here, with the 2015 Rutherford Ranch Reserve Chardonnay. This is 100% French oak, 85% of it is new, and it is aged for 10 months. 100% malolactic. So in some ways, we're sort of starting at the extreme, and then we're going to work our way down, because the other two Chardonnays that we're going to taste both have less oak and are not 100% malolactic. So we're going to start with, in many ways, what you might consider kind of that classic California, full-bodied, rich, buttery, toasty Chardonnay. Yeah. And I'm going to try to electrocute myself here. So thoughts on the wine? What do you get on the nose? Without looking at the slide.
Come block it.
Hopefully you do get that that oak character, that vanilla and toast note. You also get some of the, again, that buttery texture and the sort of the creamy mouthfeel on the palate. But yet, I think it does have a very nice, clean, dry finish. There's some good freshness of the acidity on the finish of the wine. I think, you know, Chardonnay is something that we've seen such widespread consumer love for. And yet within Chardonnay, I think what we've been moving to over the last 5 years is more diversity in profile for Chardonnay, and that consumer preferences for Chardonnay have changed a bit. And so while there are those who love really rich, oaky, buttery Chardonnays, we are seeing also preferences for different styles. And I think what you'll see here today is a range within that. So while you might see more pronounced oak on the reserve here, we're going to taste some other styles as well. Any questions or comments on the reserve? Yeah.
I like the acidity on the end of it. That's my favorite part about it.
Okay. Favorite part meaning there are other parts that aren't as appealing or are appealing? Moderately appealing?
Well, I don't really like buttery caramel wine.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's not like 100% like that. So.
Again, I think, you know, one of the challenging things that we face within the wine industry is the idea of our knowledge and our expertise and our preferences, and then thinking about what consumers are looking for. And so part of our job as wine experts and educators is to think about quality and to think about how we assess and look at the structural components of the wine, and so the fruit character, and thinking through how it was made and why, what might have gone into some of those decisions that a winemaker would make. And then to think about, if we are objective about the wine, then to let that stand in our assessment of quality, and then let those consumers out there who have a preference for that or don't have a preference for that pick and choose how they feel about the wine. So I think that's sometimes a challenge, because we all, you know, we all have our own personal preferences when it comes to wine. And I think sometimes it's a good idea as an expert to look at how you separate those so that you can be objective about a wine and think about its inherent quality and what is the balance like and what is the acidity like on the finish of that wine. And then also to think about, who does this suit, and does it suit me? Does it suit somebody else? Who's the audience for the wine? A little bit of a market researcher inside of me, too. We're going to move to the Cabernet Sauvignon. If you could also go ahead, if you want to go ahead and dump out your Chardonnay, we're going to use that first glass as the glass for the Arroyo Seco. We're going to talk now about Cabernet Sauvignon. This was again, another DNA analysis discovery that I think is so great, because we really didn't know where Cabernet Sauvignon came from and how it got its name. And then we discovered that it was a cross between Cabernet Franc and Sauvignon Blanc. And it was one of those, well, that was obvious. But we also sort of thought it was a much older grape, only to discover, really, it dates to sometime in the 1600s. So it actually doesn't have as long of a history as something, say, like Pinot Noir. It is a thick-skinned grape, so it has a lot of color and intensity and pigment there in the skins. Also, that's where you get a lot of the tannins to the wine. And it's a grape that ripens slowly. It's a grape that really does benefit from well-drained soils. We say Cabernet doesn't like to have its feet wet. In terms of aroma profiles, a lot of times you can go from sort of that, you get some underripe characters when it's sort of on the leaner, greener side, red bell pepper or green pepper. And then as it gets riper, we find more of the blackcurrant, cassis, sometimes black cherry or blackberry character, even sort of a plummy character. You can also, when depending on how you're making it, get a range that includes things like vanilla, if you're involving oak, vanilla, baking spices, and then chocolate, mocha, dark chocolate, milk chocolate, all of those different kind of characteristics. Responds very well to aging in oak, and responds very well when it's of a good quality level to being aged, and that allows the tannins to really evolve and soften, and then you start to pick up more of that sort of cedar and leather character on Cabernet. So you're next going to taste the only red wine on your mat right now, and that is the Rutherford Ranch Reserve 2012 Napa Valley Cab. As I mentioned, a little bit of oak knoll fruit, but predominantly Rutherford, so thought to get that tannic structure, again, that Rutherford dust character and structure from Rutherford, and then a little bit of that elegance and perfumed fruit character coming from the oak knoll fruit. So it spends about 2 years in French oak barrels, and this is 13.5% alcohol. We've done this wine at a number of different events and a number of different comparative tastings, and it's a wine that always holds its own against the competitive set. I think it's not, again, too extreme one way or the other. It's a pretty well-balanced wine. I think it's showing some nice development and evolution in the glass. So it gives you a chance to see how some of those 2012s are doing. 2012 was a spectacular year in the Napa Valley. They've actually had a run of some very good vintages. Obviously, yields have been an issue, though. Yields have been down in Napa Valley in particular, California. A lot of that is thought to be as a result of the drought. But they also think that due to the drought, the concentration, the yields are lower, but the grapes are still showing very high levels of concentration. So you've got some dry vintages in 2013 and 14 and 15 in particular, but 2013, for instance, Russian River Valley, producing some really high quality Pinot Noirs. So go ahead and taste the cab. I think this morning, one of the things that's kind of jumping out to me in the glass of the cab is a little bit of that tobacco and cedar character. So starting to show again some of that development on the nose. But yet you have that sort of underscoring of the blackcurrant fruit character at the same time. Any comments on this wine? Yeah.
We've had this wine in my store for about like 3 or 4 weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
Our customers are loving it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we sold like 3.5 cases of us.
That's excellent. Yeah, I think it's again, it's a wine that can benefit from extended holding for a few more years in the bottle. But at the same time, it's really, I think, nicely balanced right now, and it fits that showing a little bit of development and evolution, yet still with some really pretty Cabernet fruit characteristics and a very sort of well-balanced finish. I think it's a really nice food wine, too. Just enough tannins, but not going to overpower your meal.
Should remember the
gold prize
we discussed?
Yes.
The guy with wine and
soil. Oh, there you go. You get a second good guy at the end. Any other thoughts on the two Rutherford Ranch wines? So we're... Oh, go ahead.
I think they both show really great. I'm really impressed with the cab at the price point. I love great wine, but I love appropriately priced wines. And a topic that we were talking about during our podcast was cab is a great variety that can oftentimes transcend price points qualitatively. At least you can get a sense of identity, dark fruit, herbal qualities, tannin, grip. So you're talking about $10 cab, $30 or $40 cab. And Napa being one of the more premier appellations, it doesn't come cheap to get that kind of high quality fruit in there. And this is considerably modestly priced. Everyone does have a price sheet underneath your canvas. I forgot to mention that, as well as the tech sheets. And this to me shows cab, but it also shows sort of the pedigree of Rutherford. You know, some people might equate Rutherford perhaps with something like Poyac at Bordeaux. You know, very recognized, very prestigious, and I think there's an extraordinary sense of sense of identity in wine.
Thank you. Okay. We are going to, I think you're just waiting on one last Scott family wine to be poured. We're going to jump a little bit over, down, across to three other appellations, although we've touched upon Carneros, but we're going to spend the bulk of our time talking about Arroyo Seco, which is where the Scott family is producing two of these wines, the Pinot and the Chard, and then we've got another Chard from Carneros and another Pinot from Russian River Valley. And this is a comparison that I find is a lot of fun to do, and you should feel free to go ahead and start nosing the wines, start tasting them. They will continue to kind of evolve and develop in the glass as well. And so I please don't feel like you have to wait until we get to that particular slide to do some comparing and contrasting of these two glasses, or four glasses. So Arroyo Seco. Anybody out there been to Arroyo Seco? Yeah, two? Okay, excellent. So this is an appellation that obviously doesn't have quite the same amount of name recognition, reputation, as, say, Napa Valley or Carneros or Russian River Valley. But it is an area that I think is well worth your time, worth learning something about, and spending some time getting to know. I think, again, this goes back to that idea of discovering more and more about their terroir, the character, the soil, the climate, all of those things of different California appellations and even appellations in other parts of the New World. What we're learning about places in Australia, for instance, or the Swartland in South Africa, all just really exciting times in the wine world. Arroyo Seco is located in the middle of the Salinas Valley in Monterey County. It's a relatively small AVA. In fact, it's about a little under 19,000 acres, with about half of that currently under vine. So there is some potential for expansion, although you'll see in just a minute that at one point there was a lot more planted in the area. So there's actually been a reduction over time of the number of vines in the ground. It's about 40 miles from Monterey Bay, and this becomes very important if you've ever been to Monterey to know kind of what it's cool, but it's also cool from the weather sense as well. And part of that has to do with this very deep bay, the Blue Grand Canyon, so to speak, that you have off the coast of California here in Monterey. It is considered a cool climate. In fact, it has one of the longest growing seasons in California. Generally, if we were to ask Laurel for harvest updates from Rutherford and from Scott, Arroyo Seco is about 3 to 4 weeks behind, typically, most of the other AVAs that they're harvesting from, so Russian River or Carneros or Napa. So it is a good growing place for Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Riesling, grapes that like to have a longer, slower evolution on the vine. Again, well-respected by critics, and we've really started to see an uptick in interest in the wines of a Rosecco, but it's not an area that has a huge level of consumer awareness or consumer knowledge. So the modern history of the region really dates from the early 1960s. This is when two UC Davis professors, maybe heard of both of them, and Winkler, obviously they're the, you know, the whole degree days in California, the weather system of assessing the suitability of an area to planting for grapes. Very well-respected professors who said, this is an area that people should be looking at for planting grapes. It's got a great climate. Go in and take a look. Well, you've got Fuente, Mariso, Palmasan, Almaden. Lots of people went in to start planting in the area, in the region. In fact, there was a surge, 25 acres of vineyards planted between 1972 and 1974. So that's a lot in this area. And this was all terrific in many ways, but at the same time, they started running into some problems. And part of that is that while, and this is as you start studying things like degree days and climate around the wine world, you start to realize that it's not just the amount of sunlight or the temperature, the average temperature of an area that kind of comes into play. It's really the whole microclimate of the region. And one of the things that they really sort of struggled with in this area had to do with the diurnal temperature variation in the area, the winds that came into play in the area, especially in the afternoon, and the fog. So really sort of the more subtle nuances of the microclimate really played a role in impacting the style and the quality of the wines that were produced in the early 70s. So the other problem that they were having were, you know, vines were spaced very far apart. They were doing a lot of overhead watering, and the use of clones in the area was probably not as fine-tuned as we're going to find more in the 80s and the 90s. So growers really had to rethink what they were doing, how to deal with this Monterey Mistral, so to speak, the winds that would come sweeping down the valley. I often think of Oklahoma and the winds sweeping down the plain. But here we have the Monterey Mistral sweeping down the valley. And so what they started to do was to tweak the vineyards, to move to drip irrigation, to plant the vines closer together, to increase competition among the vines, which usually increases concentration in the grapes if the vines have to struggle a little bit more, if it's not quite so easy for them to grow, to change the way the vines were trellised, more sort of traditional viticulture rather than the California sprawl where the vines were just allowed to kind of go a little crazy. And also looking at changing row orientation because of the effect of that wind. So maybe designing the vineyards a little bit differently. And then, of course, looking at clones. And that's one reason why you have the use of the Dijon clone here for both the Chardonnay and the Pinot from Arroyo Seco. And that was because some of the early clones that they were using in the 60s and 70s, a lot of them you find a lot of the Fuente clone, which is a great Chardonnay clone, very famous in California and does a beautiful job. But it wasn't maybe the best all-around clone of Chardonnay to be using in Arroyo Seco. So growers started thinking, well, what other areas are growing Chardonnay? And they started looking at Oregon, which had been bringing in some Burgundy clones, nicknamed the Dijon clones. And there are several different Dijon clones of Chardonnay and Pinot. And they started planting those in Arroyo Seco. And they feel like the use of different clones within the area and the diversity there is something that it not only gives the winemaker a bigger paint box to use to create a wine from, but also that these were clones that maybe were a little bit better adapted to the particular microclimate of Arroyo Seco.
I'm curious about that.
Yeah.
I may be ignorant, but while I'm asking the question, I guess.
Go for it.
So when you talk about changing the clones, are you talking about bringing in vines and grafting them from other
yes.
places? And is it like a wholesale, or do they just piecemeal it season by season? They do part of vineyards and then another part? Or?
So, I mean, it can depend. It can depend on the winery. It can depend on the health of the vines. It can depend on the age of the vineyard. So, I mean, in many ways, there's not one single answer. But a lot of times what what people will come in and do is regraft and do parts at a time, so you're not maybe completely losing all of the production of your vineyard.
Kind of hedging the bets.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of winemaking is hedging the bets, right? You know, should we pick today or should we pick Thursday? What's the weather going to say? Well, maybe we'll pick half our vineyard today and then the rest on Thursday. Or, you know, when do we have our labor force? Labor is a huge issue right now within the wine industry. And just as a side note, do you know what one of the new competitors for labor in California is? What just became legal in California?
Oh, yeah.
It's a very interesting discussion these days.
Perhaps I answer too loud.
It's a very interesting. There are a lot of people who are losing workers to marijuana crops. So labor in California is a key issue on the mind of a lot of growers. We have, for the MW, the final portion of the MW exam includes something called the research paper, where you have a question that you investigate. And one of the more interesting papers I've read recently was written by a guy that looked at harvesting in Napa and Sonoma, and this idea of handcrafted and hand-picking versus sort of mechanical labor, mechanical harvesting, and also the role of labor in California Appalachian. So it's a really timely, interesting discussion, but I digress. So Arroyo Seco means dry riverbed, literally, it means dry riverbed, runs from a steep, narrow gorge right here, this is the gorge part, at the foot of the Santa Lucia Mountain Range, and then it broadens out into the middle of the Salinas Valley. I like to think that this looks, to me, in my head, in my geographically challenged mind, a bit like a backwards New York State. It works for me. So this part actually reminds me a little bit of Long Island. I grew up on Long Island, so it's home for me. My name is really Sherry Sorda, and I have a dog named Twan Twan. But that reminds me a little bit of Long Island, and then this would be a reverse New York State. And so if you kind of keep this part in your head, this shape, as we go through, I think it gets easy to pick out where Arroyo Seco sits within all of Monterey. So again, right here, this nice little triangle shape right there, that's Arroyo Seco. So as I mentioned, number of different microclimates here. Also because of this little extension of the gorge, but its proximity to the ocean, and in many ways its placement sort of smack in the middle, gives it even more of a mix than you might find in other places. So you have, this is called the thermal rainbow of Monterey AVA, and again, I've maps that are colorful, I think I'm just intrinsically drawn to, and I think this is a great one, because you really can start to see the movement of air and the change in temperature, and you start to think, wow, that makes sense that you've got certain grape varieties planted up here that like cooler temperatures, and you maybe are looking at other grape varieties down here where it gets warmer. And you even have some spots further up where, due to the microclimate, due to the way the land is shaped, can have a temperature swing as well. And you can see that over the course of the day, it starts out pretty cool, and then there are only certain parts kind of in the middle of the day that start to warm up, and then the temperature drops again in the evening. I live right now in North Carolina, and one of the things that we don't really have a great situation with is diurnal temperature variation. And when I moved from New York down to North Carolina, and I do a lot of shopping at farmer markets, I noticed a real difference in my tomatoes and my strawberries in particular. And I think a lot of it, if you can take some of those experiences and translate them over to grapes, you start to think about the preservation of acidity. And in my mind, that lack of diurnal temperature variation in North Carolina, where I live, it started to make sense in terms of the fruit and the vegetables. I guess tomatoes are technically fruits too, but to not have the freshness of that acidity. And so when you get a place that has that drop in the evening to preserve natural fresh acidity, it can make a real difference in the final product, whether it's your tomatoes or your strawberries or your grapes. So this is Arroyo Seco up close, and I have you have this map, I believe, in your packets as well. And I have put stars on all of the Scott family vineyards here. So this is the Zanetta Ranch. It's located kind of right in the middle, in the valley floor. And then this is Windmill right here, kind of in the elbow. We also have Petite Slope right here. And then these two vineyards, Twin Oak and Vaquero, which are actually separated by this river that runs through, probably red pit fans. And then it's actually more of a dry riverbed up through here, a little bit more water over here. So you can divide the Arroyo Seco Appalachian itself. I've mentioned the gorge, but you also have the riverbed and the southern benchland and then the western benchland. You find a lot of grapes planted over here. You'll also find a lot of cactus in the area as well. So this is these are some of the images of Arroyo Seco driving through the valley, and you can notice here this layer of fog that settles over the valley that you, as you drive down in the morning, is really just so pronounced. This is the Windmill Vineyard, and you can see, again, it's a sort of a lower point in the valley, and you can't quite make it out, but this is actually water that's running through the property here. This is the gorge, and again, if anybody is as directionally challenged as I am, you can see I've rotated the map so you can kind of get a sense of the orientation here, that this elbow sticks out, and then the ocean is over here on this side. But one of the things that you start to notice is that the fog is lifting, lifts earlier over in the gorge portion compared to the rest of the Appalachian. And so this is right around the same time as the previous pictures were taken, maybe about a 15-minute difference. But you can see as you get further into the gorge, this is Vaquero and this is Twin Oak, that there is no fog actually over here. So that's actually one reason why you have this mixture planted within some of these different properties of both Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but also in some of the vineyard, as the vineyard kind of extends down through the gorge, you'll find some Bordeaux varietals as well. And this is actually the little river that separates the two properties. Depending on the rain, this can be very dried out, and a lot of times, kind of in the winter, it's it can be fuller and a little bit harder to cross. So the other thing that's pretty interesting about Arroyo Seco, as I mentioned, dry riverbed is what the name means, is that it was, in many parts, a dry riverbed. And you find this mixture of these gravelly, sandy soils with very large river stones. And in fact, the stones themselves have a nickname. They're called Greenfield potatoes. There's a town called Greenfield in the area. And what do these remind you of? They help with drainage, they absorb sunlight and reflect some of that sunlight back up into the mine. What other area has it? Yeah, Châteauneuf-du-Pape, so with those big galet stones. So very similar here, and these are really substantial in size. And depending on where you are within the Appalachian, your vineyards can have more or less of these large greenfield potatoes. Down in the valley, you'll see in a few pictures, they tend to be a little bit smaller. Smaller rocks and finer, but up in some of, especially in the gorge, you find really large greenfield potatoes. In fact, this is Vaquero. All of these stones here to the side, these were removed from this vineyard when the vineyard was planted by hand. And we talk about, you know, tectonic uplift and plate movement, and this is sort of the as I mentioned, the gorge. It's kind of, it starts to get up a little higher, and then you have this sort of nice sort of cut down to the river, and you can you get a lot of exposed soils here, and you can see the different layers and the different folding that has taken place over time. It's quite dramatic. This is, again, sort of cut away as you go kind of down between the two, Vaquero and Twin Oaks, and you can see the different, how far down these big river stones go into the soil. And I really do wish that I put my hand or foot or phone or something on one of these stones so that you could get a sense of the size of these. They are quite prominent in the area. This is the Zanetta Ranch, and so this, again, is located kind of around where that number four is. This is more down within the valley part of the Appalachian. You can see here that the stones get a lot smaller, and that the soil is a lot finer down there. An up-close shot of the Zanetta plant, of the ranch, and the plants. We're going to jump quickly over to Russian River Valley, and then we're going to jump right into tasting these four wines. So we're jumping back up to Sonoma here, an AVA that was granted in 1983 and then enlarged in 2005, named for the Russians who settled in the area in the early 1800s. Here's our map of Sonoma with Russian River kind of in the middle, and the appellation that I think wins one of the prizes for the longest name ever, the Green Valley of Russian River Valley AVA, which is located right there. So Russian River Valley, just like Oro Seco and Carneros, we have a really, again, interesting situation in terms of this combination of fog and terroir, the geology of the area. So these soils, here we have a mixture of ancient bedrock and some volcanic soil, volcanic ash, that was deposited there by the collision of tectonic plates millions of years ago. And again, this idea of these well-draining alluvial soils. We have fog that helps to moderate temperatures. You can have that diurnal temperature swing that can be as much as 40 degrees. There's actually an appellation down at the, an AVA down at the southern part of Monterey, where that diurnal temperature variation can get up to 60 degree difference between day and night, which is pretty pronounced. So this two key soils to know within the Russian River Valley are these Goldridge and Sebastopol soils. Sebastopol has a higher clay content than Goldridge. Goldridge is actually a very fine sort of sandy loam over fractured sandstone. And that, again, these are soils that the grapes can have the ability to kind of dig deep down into the soil, which helps to promote stability in the grapevine. It helps the deeper the root system, the more established the root system, the more the plant can withstand things like drought stress and illnesses and things like that. And so having those kind of friable soils is pretty important. We're going to next talk a little bit about Pinot Noir, or Pinot, an extremely old grape variety, and they think domesticated over 2,000 years ago. So many different mutations of Pinot, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, but a grape that, again, was early on recognized as having such a high level of quality that you even have Philip the Bold in 1395 outlawing Gamay in Beaujolais, in Burgundy, kicking it down to Beaujolais so that they would only focus on Pinot Noir, on the higher quality grapevines. Pinot Noir is, I think, rightly called the heartbreak grape, a bit of a finicky grape. We were talking earlier, it's very hard to produce average quality, inexpensive Pinot Noir. It's sort of like that poem, when she was good, she was good.
Okay.
Siri is responding to my voice. I'm glad she didn't call me by the nickname my son refers to me as, which is Parker and Otis Paper Towel, Executive Platinum American Airlines Lady, which is quite a mouthful, but that's actually a joke with my son, and he made Siri change my nickname, so it's occasionally embarrassing when that goes off. It's a hard, long story. Anyway, when she was good, she was good. When she was bad, she was awful, and that's a little bit what Pinot Noir is. Very thin skin, so it can be prone to problems, to disease. It is a grape that needs to be tended carefully. It needs to have the right climate, including a cooler climate. I often talk about Pinot Noir when it's grown in climates that I think are a bit too warm, can tend to have this really sort of odd take on, if you've ever grown tomatoes, that smell you get on your hands after you've handled a tomato plant, this sort of idea of overripe, underripe. There's a greenness, but at the same time, there's a ripeness. And I think Pinot that ripens too quickly, sort of too early, it doesn't give the rest of the grape time to catch up. And for some reason, in my mind, that's my association, is this sort of tomato leaf character. But it creates sort of this, I think, unbalanced style of Pinot Noir. And I think you need to have that cooler climate to allow Pinot to ripen slowly so that it does take on those really beautiful, expressive cherry, raspberry, strawberry notes. And yet, at the same time, it can still have sort of that earth character, that whether it's mushroom or forest floor or herbal, savory kind of character. Pinot is in many ways beautiful because of that unique combination of both fruit and savory characteristics. It's a grape that has a lower level of tannins and color compared to, say, something like Cabernet Sauvignon, but at the same time is incredibly age-worthy and has a really natural high level of acidity. So the four wines that we're going to taste here today from the three different appellations, all from the Scott family estate, named after the family's maternal grandfather, Raymond Scott, who was Scottish. So he came from Scotland. I think that's how he got his name. But he came over during the California Gold Rush and settled in California. The wines, I think, you'll find have a really interesting ability to reflect these different terroirs. And I think offer a really interesting comparison in terms of Chardonnay produced in two similar but yet slightly different climates, and same with the Pinot Noir. So Arroyo Seco and Carneros, these refer to the first two wines here, the two Chardonnays. Again, both considered locations, cool climate locations for Pinot and Chard. Low rainfall, shallow, well-draining soils, both affected by wind and fog. But the expression, I think, of the grape here is going to be a little different. In your packets, you have the 2014 Arroyo Seco Chardonnay. You are actually tasting the 2015. So this slide is correct, but your slide in your packet for the Arroyo Seco Chard says 2014. So you might want to change some of the notes that are on your slide. They're correct in your book for the 2014, but this is actually what you're tasting is the 2015. So go ahead and start tasting through these two Chardonnays, and we will compare. Has everyone had a chance to taste at least the first one? Okay, so I'm going to just flip slides over so they can see the second one as well. I almost wish we could do these side by side here. So you can see there are some slight differences here. The Arroyo Seco is 14.5% alcohol, partial MLF, 50% barrel fermented, 8 months in American oak. The Carneros Chardonnay is a little bit less in terms of the MLF, so 35%, and it is aged in a combination of French and American, 100% barrel fermented, and aged 8 months surly, but 13.5% alcohol. The alcohol levels on these wines, you'll notice because you have the 2014 information, does vary depending on the vintage, so really can run between 13.5 to 14.5, depending on the vintage. So the 2015 in Arroyo Seco is a bit higher than it is in Carneros, but this was actually different for the 2014 vintage. So what kind of differences do you notice on the nose and the palate here for these two wines? Because I do think when you start to really dig into it, there are some differences in terms of fruit profile, and then in terms of on the palate, the texture of both of these wines, and the nature of the finish on both of these wines. So who has thoughts? What do you think, Arthur?
I think they're pretty different. I think one definitely has more acid structure than two. Not to say that two is acid deficient, it's just more linear. And then two is a little more opulent. Oak's more evident, more stone fruit, to me, riper fruit than wine number one.
Yep. Completely agree.
Yeah, but I just tasted them once each, but it seemed like pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it comes to tasting, like I love it when things actually back up, like what's in the glass backs up the theory. I don't need that.
You sure? I could stand next to you.
No, get away. Thank you. But like when that what you learn about ripening, acid going down, and correlation of sugar going up, blah blah blah. When you just put your nose in the glass and taste it, you're like, yeah, this isn't all. Yes, you know, it does actually add up. It does manifest in the glass. And I thought they were wonderful representations of where they're coming from.
I think they also speak to this idea of Verosecco versus Carneros in my mind. You know, you have sort of an appellation that's not as well known, that's a little bit more quote unquote up and coming, versus something that's more established, almost more sort of classic when you think about California Chardonnay. And so I think you see some of the differences there too. And I think if you look at these in terms of drinking occasions, I think there is an openness to the 2015 Verosecco, that it would be a good, you know, it's got really nice acidity, so it's a good food wine, but at the same time, there's a more pronounced fresh fruit character that I think makes it also good for, you know, just a sipping wine. Whereas I think there is, there's a different level of complexity to the Carneros, that you have kind of, again, that almost that combination of both fruit and savory herbs on the finish, that it the finish kind of goes on a little bit longer than the Verosecco. And I think it makes it more of a wine, I think, for sort of contemplating or for having some more potential to age and develop a little bit longer. But I think they both represent two really interesting examples of both their appellations and of Chardonnay as well. Any other comments on these two? Yeah.
I think the first one is a better aroma.
Okay.
Or at least more aroma than the second one.
Yeah, I think the 2015 Carneros is also, we saw this yesterday. We did a luncheon with these two wines and paired them with food, and that was again also really interesting to see how they changed within the pairing. But the Carneros is a little bit, these are 2015, so still babies, and the 2015 Carneros is a little bit closed compared to the 2015 Verosecco, which is kind of got, again, more openness and tropical fruit and floral character on the nose than you find on the Carneros.
I haven't been looking at the alcohol, ABVs on the stats. Are the alcohol levels comparable?
The Carneros is 13.5. The Verosecco is actually higher. It's 14.5.
Okay. Yeah, to me, that wasn't as evident as the acid structure being so noticeably different.
Yep.
Which, you know, could be good alcohol integration in both cases. And Patrick, notice how your preference or what you said, you know, you thought had a better fruit or you liked it more with glass number one not being so oak dominant. But I would, you know, stand by Sherry and saying characteristic words like has a better nose or something like that within the consumers and as a retailer, especially because someone might really like, you know, oak, and to defend and say one's better than another is not the most tactful way of trying to guess this way.
I meant like it was stronger. I said better.
More pronounced. Yeah.
Like it's more expressive, Patrick.
Okay. Anybody else? Well, let's go ahead also and move over to the Pinots. Again, Verosecco, Russian River Valley, two areas, cool climates for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Hopefully it was empty. And affected by fog and wind. Although, interestingly enough, in Russian River Valley, the idea is that the fog is timed slightly differently, that it comes in the evening and then goes out to the ocean the following morning. So you have some presence of fog overnight. In Arroyo Seco, the idea is the fog comes in early in the morning and also again in the late afternoon, but can disappear during the day and in the late evening. And so supposedly, I will put this out to you because I still I feel like I'd like to stand there in Russian River Valley overnight to really see this for myself. It's one of those things where when you read it, you start to really question, and you should. You should question that and hopefully see it for yourself. But supposedly, the timing of the fog is a little bit different, which can affect the microclimate, which can affect the ripening, which can affect, again, the preservation of the acidity in the wine. So that can be something, if you're looking for sort of a differentiating factor between the two, that could be something to look to. And then again, within the soils, you have that fractured sandstone in the gold rift soil in Russian River Valley versus these rocky, gravelly soils with green-filled potatoes in Arroyo Seco. So the 2014 Pinot Noirs, we're going to be tasting 2014 for Arroyo Seco and for Russian River Valley. 14.5% alcohol, 11 months in French oak, a mixture of old and new. 2014, again, warm, dry vintage, but there was a pretty moderate, mild summer, and that was something that helped to preserve the acidity in the grapes, even though they'd had some issues, again, with drought and with heat in the spring. The Russian River Valley, also 14.5% alcohol, also aged 11 months in French oak, a mixture of new and old. 2013 was a spectacular vintage in Russian River Valley. 2014 considered also to be pretty good, but again, lower yields due to some issues with drought stress. So take a look at these two, because I think even more than the Chardonnays, there are some differences evident in the character of, in the expression of Pinot on these two wines, and so I'll be intrigued to see what you guys pick up on these two.
Can we see the previous slide?
Absolutely. Oh yeah, because I think you have 2013 in your handouts. Again, apologize for that. We weren't totally sure of vintage selection.
Are they using the same cooperage?
Yes, I believe so.
Are these different?
Yes.
Yeah. One from Russian River has so much more tan and it's darker color. I mean, you really feel that.
You can also, I think, if you just on the nose alone, to me, there's much more of a cherry fruit character on the Arroyo Seco versus a raspberry note on the Russian River. I mean, just nose alone, so different. And yes, color, if you're comparing the colors, there's a difference in the color for the two wines as well. I think on the palate, too, there's not just, I think you made a point about tannins. I think that's noticeable as well. But I think in terms of structure and concentration, there's a difference in the two wines as well. I think the Russian River Valley, you could say, has more stuffing to it, right? That the concentration is noticeable there. More what?
Bracing.
More bracing. Yeah, I think, again, though, you do get that freshness, that acidity on the Arroyo Seco. And it is, remember when I was playing flight attendant and I was saying Arroyo Seco is kind of this, and Russian River and Carneros are more
this?
Well, I think these four wines kind of demonstrate. That was why I was playing flight attendant. I think there is a linear aspect on the palate of both of the Arroyo Seco wines, whereas the broadness and a density on the Carneros and the Russian River Valley that is different. And again, it's not to say that one is better than the other. It's to show the difference, and the difference as it's expressed in both, you know, terroir and in terms of grape variety.
For the record, if there's anybody anticipating more advanced wine examination, they love it when you do that. As your answer.
Yes, thank you. Buckle up.
Yeah.
Well, wings versus aisle.
Well, what's going on here? next, it's a great way to put it, because I totally agree. Two is more fleshed out. The first one's a little more linear, more acid focused, more bright cherry fruit, whereas the raspberry fruit is more hedonistic and kind of decadent. And then number two, I asked about the cooper because I think the oak really manifests differently in the two of them.
I agree.
First one's kind of pretty classic bacon spice of French. The second one's a little more toasty and a little more caramelized. So if you're using the same cooper, I mean, I'm kind of wondering, you know, are they both new? Is one a little bit newer?
I think there's a bit more new oak on the Russian River Valley. I will have to double check. The winemaker who used to be there didn't love to share a lot of information. You had to kind of pull it out of him. But the guy who's replaced him is actually a lot more forthcoming with technical specifications. That can always be a challenge.
I think the alcohol too is a little bit higher as well than the first one. I think that's the alcohol deviation in this part of the Chardonnay, I think, is much more apparent. A little bit warmer in the rest of the two. But both
three oak fits the Russian River one better too, though.
What's that?
I think the oak fits the Russian River one better.
Oh, I think still it's a beautiful one, yeah. It's balanced.
I think they're both good, but I think that the oak stands on its own. In the whereas it's kind of more incorporated in the Russian River.
If you have that kind of like oak toastiness and presence in conflict with the brighter, more fresh cherry fruit,
yep.
Number one, I don't think it would work out. But the fruit is more sweeter, definitely saturated, aromatic. But number two, I mean, that's how it can stand up to that oak is a little prominent.
You know, we're getting tight on time.
We can probably stop recording because that's not being caught anyway, just to have open discussion if you want. So I'll just turn that off.
Sure. Well, actually, we just have a few more slides, and then there is some lunch in there for you guys. So just as sort of a final wrap-up, a few just sort of thoughts about terroir, and that these are areas to start to get to know, to think about the influence of the microclimate, the influence of soil, and that unique combination that we have in terms of soil grape variety and climate and the hand of a winemaker, that what we're looking to do with these wines is to produce wines that reflect these appellations, these AVAs. In terms of things that affect quality, again, to start to think objectively about quality and what goes into quality and thinking about the location and the grapes, the soils, and the techniques that allow for the expression of these things so that you're not trying to dominate the wine with too much oak or not trying to dominate the wine with too much malolactic, that you're allowing the grapes to express the quality and the character of the area. And then just finally a note about Rutherford and the Scott family, that these are wines with a commitment to family, wines with distinction. These are wines that are generally receive really positive consumer feedback. People look at these as a great value, a great wine at this price point, and wines that are focused on quality and sustainability and on fitting a variety of different palate types and preferences. So with that, I am going to turn it back over to Arthur or to Susan. And thank you very much for your time today. I greatly appreciate it. It has been a privilege. Thank you.
So if you want to grab one of your glasses, there's plenty of wine in the back to have a food. Please stay and have some food and discuss with everybody. That would be great. And we're going to work on cleaning up the room. If you're interested in these wines or what wine you are interested in, I left my card with everything so that you can get with me or your salesperson. We do carry all of these wines with the exception right now of the Russian River and the Carneros. Those are available on the bus. Thanks for coming.